Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Joshua chapter 6. I'm going to do the entire 27 verses of the chapter. We will discuss the fall of Jericho. Our context is this. In our last chapter, Joshua 5, we saw that the new generation of Israelites who had been born in the wilderness were circumcised right outside of Gilgal. And then 4 days after that, 5 days after that, or 4 days after that, I should say, they had their first Passover in Canaan. And so now they're facing their first city that they have to beat in order to take the land of Canaan. Jericho was sort of at the entrance there. If they didn't take it and they went deeper into Israel, they would have an enemy in their rear, which would come get them eventually. And so they had to get Jericho. So we start now in verses 1 through 3 of Joshua 6. Now Jericho was tightly shut because of the sons of Israel. No one went out and no one came in. The Lord said to Joshua, "See, I have given Jericho into your hand with its king and the valiant warriors. You shall march around the city, all the men of war, circling the city once. You shall do so for 6 days. Now no one went out of Jericho, as verse 1 says. In other words, no one came out to make a sally on the Israelites. And no one came in, i.e. to bring provisions in. So Jericho must have had enough provisions to withstand a siege. And of course, the Israelites had no siege equipment. They were not equipped to besiege any city. Now in verse 2, the Lord said to Joshua, this is probably the angel of Jehovah, Jesus, who appeared in the last chapter with the sword in front of the city as Joshua went out to reconnoiter Jericho. He went out and he saw this angel, and this, by common consent, is the angel of the Lord. We showed you the evidence for that in the last chapter. So the Lord, the angel of Jehovah, Jesus, said to Joshua, "See, I have given Jericho into your hand." Now, Adam Clark says it may have been more than just Jericho that the angel of the Lord was giving into Joshua's hand. Perhaps some of the seven pagan nations, in other words, all the ites of Canaan, had come to Jericho to help. Clark cites Joshua 24, verse 11. "You crossed the Jordan and came to Jericho, and the citizens of Jericho fought against you, and the Amorite, and the Perizzite, and the Canaanite, and the Hittite, and the Girgashite, the Hivite, and the Jebusite. Thus I gave them into your hand." It does sound like the other nations did help Joshua here, although, of course, the other ites might have fought later. It's not totally clear from the verse, but it sounds like this was a big deal. A lot of the ites banded together. A lot of the pagan tribes of Canaan banded together to save Jericho. Verse 3 says, "You shall march around the city." Now, the order of march is not clear. We're going to talk about this a little bit as we get into the chapter. Soldiers marched around, priests marched around, the people marched around, as we'll see later on in the chapter, but their order of march is not clear. Now, the people that marched included the women and children and men under 20. It says here in verse 3 that the men of war circled the city, but we go down to verse 7, and Joshua says to the people, "March around the city." So we got people marching too. It seems to me the logical order as they marched around the city would be the priest first, then the soldiers, then the people. We'll get more precise as we go on as far as how they marched around the city. We go now to Joshua chapter 6, verses 4 through 7. "Also, seven priests shall carry seven trumpets of ram's horns before the ark. Then on the seventh day you shall march around the city seven times, and the priests shall blow the trumpets. It shall be that when they make a long blast with the ram's horn, and when you hear the sound of the trumpet, all the people shall shout with a great shout, and the wall of the city will fall down flat, and the people will go every man straight ahead." So much for the need for siege engines. "So Joshua the son of Nun called the priests and said to them, 'Take up the Ark of the Covenant and let seven priests carry seven trumpets of ram's horns before the Ark of the Lord.' Then he said to the people, 'Go forward and march around the city and let the armed men go on before the Ark of the Lord.'" Now you will notice the number 7 is very prominent in these four verses because that's the covenant number of Israel. 7 days, 7 years, and the seventh Sabbath year is the seventh year. Then you got seven sevens, and then you got the year of Jubilee. 7, 7, 7s everywhere. Now let me read you what Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say about this covenant number of 7. Quote, The design of this whole proceeding was obviously to impress the Canaanites with a sense of the divine omnipotence, to teach the Israelites a memorable lesson of faith and confidence in God's promises, and to inspire sentiments of respect and reverence for the ark as the symbol of his presence. The length of time during which those circuits were made tended the more intensely to arrest the attention and deepen the impressions, both of the Israelites and the enemy. The number 7 was among the Israelites the symbolic seal of the covenant between God and their nation. Now, these 7 priests that are marching before the ark, they are carrying 7 ram's horns. Now, it's interesting that some say that it was not ram's horns that they were carrying, but rather jubilee trumpets of silver or gold. Let's see what Adam Clark says. Quote, the Hebrew word yobelim, if I pronounce that right, does not signify ram's horns, nor do any of the ancient versions the Chaldee accepted give it this meaning. The instruments used on this occasion were evidently of the same kind with those used on the Jubilee, and were probably made of horn or of silver, and the text in this place may be translated, and 7 priests shall bear before the ark the 7 Jubilee trumpets, not 7 ram's horns, but 7 Jubilee trumpets, for they appear to have been the same kind as those used on the Jubilee. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say that the Hebrew is horns of Jubilee, that is, the bent or crooked trumpets with which the Jubilee was proclaimed. It is probable that the horns of this animal were used at first, and that afterwards, when metallic trumpets were introduced, the primitive name as well as form of them was traditionally continued. I think that makes sense, so we'll assume that these priests are blowing silver trumpets, Jubilee trumpets. Quite impressive. The ark that they were marching in front of course, contained the law, which symbolized that the miraculous subduing of Jericho was due to the power and presence of God because he was inherent in that law. Now, it says that on the 7th day, the priest will march around the city 7 times, which is different than the first 6 days, and the priest shall blow the trumpets. That's unclear. It looks, sounds like the priest might have been blowing the trumpets only on the 7th day when they marched around 7 times. However, we can see later in verse 8 and verses 11 through 14 that the trumpets were blown every day, the first 6 days. Joshua 6:8. After Joshua had spoken to the people, 7 priests carrying 7 trumpets before the Lord moved forward and blew the trumpets. The ark of the Lord's covenant followed them. And so, of course, verse 8 is right at the beginning of this whole episode. Joshua 6:11 through 14. So the ark of the Lord was carried around the city, circling it once. They returned to the camp and spent the night there. That was the first day around the city. Joshua got up early the next morning. The priest took the ark of the Lord, and the 7 priests carrying 7 trumpets marched in front of the ark of the Lord while the trumpets were blowing. That's on the second day, and we'll assume the first day too. While the trumpets were blowing, the armed troops went in front of them, and the rear guard went behind the ark of the Lord. On the second day, they marched around the city. So on the second day, they blew the trumpets. We could assume that it's all 6 days plus the 7th day. They're blowing trumpets. Now, there's a difference between the blowing of trumpets normally, because there's going to be one long blast of the trumpet at the very end. That's when the people hear that long blast. They shout, and the walls of the city are going to fall down, and they're going to march into the city and take it. Now, the walls of the city are said to fall flat. They will fall flat. Some have said because of that, the foundation of the walls opened and the walls sank into the chasm. Well, I don't think it says that. I mean, it could fall flat. It could mean they fall flat on the ground, not necessarily into a hole under the ground or in the ground. If the walls fell flat on the ground, of course, the Israelites would have to pick their way through the rubble to get into the city, but I don't think that's, might be an inconvenience, but it's not an obstacle that prohibits the capture of the city. And of course, let's just talk about speculation now about why the walls fell. I've got a quote later saying that it's absolutely dumb to say it's the blowing of the trumpets and the shouting of the people that somehow naturally caused the walls to fall down. You can blow horns of walls all day long, they're not going to fall. My guess is it was an earthquake, providentially timed or miraculously timed, however you want to put it, that knocked the walls down. Now, even if the walls fell flat on the ground and there was rubble there, nonetheless, the army didn't need to converge at a breach in the wall like you normally do when you besiege a city, because the whole wall was breached. The whole wall was down. They could just go in wherever they wanted to, and there was nothing stopping them. Now, the people are said in verse 7 to march around the wall, as I said earlier. That would be the women and children and men under 20. Now, in just a minute, in a few verses, I'm going to give you the order of march, how these priests and soldiers and ordinary civilians walked around the walls of Jericho. Now, armed men are said to accompany the ark as they go around the walls. Now, it has been, I think, quite cogently pointed out that that cannot refer to all 600 plus thousand soldiers of the Israelites marching around the city. Let me give you a quote from Clark. He says, "It is not likely that the whole Israelitish host went each day around the city. This would have been utterly impossible. The fighting men alone amounted to nearly 600,000, independently of the people, who must have amounted to at least 2 or 3 million. We may therefore safely assert that only a select number, such as was deemed necessary for the occasion, were employed. Jericho could not have been a large city, and to reduce it could not have required 1/100th part of the armed force under the command of Joshua." And Jameson Fawcett agrees with that. Some restrict the number to the 40,000 of Reuben, Gad, and Manasseh. I don't know why they would be so honored. But at any rate, a subset of the army was walking around the walls, most probably. And note, they had to have marched around the walls out of range of any missiles that would be thrown from the city from the walls. We go now to Joshua 6, verses 8 through 11. "And it was so that when Joshua had spoken to the people, the 7 priests carrying the 7 trumpets of ram's horns before the Lord went forward and blew the trumpets. And the ark of the covenant of the Lord followed them. The armed men went before the priest who blew the trumpets, and the rear guard came after the ark, while they continued to blow the trumpets. But Joshua commanded the people, saying, 'You shall not shout, nor let your voice be heard, nor let a word proceed out of your mouth until the day I tell you, shout, then you shall shout.' So he had the ark of the Lord taken around the city, circling it once. Then they came into the camp and spent the night in the camp." Now the ark of the covenant is in this procession going around the walls, and in that ark, the 2 tablets of the law were there. That's why it's called the ark of the covenant, because it's the ark which contains the covenant of the law, the Mosaic covenant in the law. Now, there's an armed guard mentioned here and a rear guard coming after the ark, the armed guard going before the ark. So here's the procession. Well, first of all, what is this rear guard? Let's talk about that. That's in verse 9. Of course, it could have just been a contingent of soldiers, but Adam Clark suggests maybe it contains the baggage train for the soldiers. Maybe it contains the people carrying the sacred articles belonging to the ark. That would be the manna, Aaron's rods, which budded and so forth. Maybe even the articles that go with the tabernacle, the golden lampstand, the table of showbread, the golden altar of incense. Who knows? We can speculate. Some people speculate it was the tribe of Dan because they always brought up the rear. Numbers 10:25, that was their order of march. Doesn't really matter. It was a rear guard of soldiers. And so the order of march was this. You got the priest in the front. Well, excuse me. We get this from the next verses 12 through 16. I'm going to jump down here since I'm on this topic. You got the armed troops in front of everybody. And then you got the 7 priests blowing their trumpets. Then you got the ark. And then you got the rear guard behind the ark. And then behind the rear guard, you got all the people. And that's how they marched. Doesn't say the people were behind the rear guard, but we can assume that that's true. So that's how they were marching. And they were marching in silence, except for the blowing of the trumpets. So let's put ourselves in the scene here. What might have been your attitude if you were a citizen of Jericho? You're marching, you're watching this people march with a portion of their soldiers marching around your city, blowing trumpets and not saying anything. Now, I would think that that silence would make the people of Jericho feel spooked and on edge. I mean, these people have already heard about the events in Egypt when the people came out after their God, Yahweh, had done a number on the Egyptians with the 10 plagues, and then they got across the Jordan River. Well, they got across the Red Sea miraculously, and then they came across the Jordan River miraculously as the waters backed up. They were probably pretty scared, in my opinion. However, Adam Clark has a different attitude of what might have been a different opinion as to what might have been the attitude of the people of Jericho. He quotes a source called Bishop Hall. Clark says this, "It must have been a strange sight. No mound was raised, no siege mound, no sword drawn, no engine planted, no siege engine, no pioneers undermining, no sappers. Here were armed men, but no stroke given. They must walk and not fight. Doubtless the people of Jericho made themselves merry with the spectacle." They're, according to Clark's speculation, they were laughing at all this. And that laughter would have necessitated an increase of faith on the part of the Hebrews who had to undergo this ridicule. Hebrews 11:30 says, "By faith the walls of Jericho fell down after they had been encircled for 7 days. By faith." They had to believe the Israelites. Well, I think they had to believe either way. I think that makes more sense that they were probably scared. I don't think the Jericho people in Jericho were laughing at the Israelites. I think they were shaking in their boots, in my humble opinion. Now, it could be some were scared and some were mocking. That is a possibility. But I think the silence added to the gravity and solemnity of the occasion. After all, the symbol of God's divine presence, the ark, was before the walls there. They see that, and I bet you they're pretty scared. We go now to Joshua 6, verses 12 through 16. Joshua got up early the next morning. The priest took the ark of the Lord, and the seven priests carrying seven trumpets marched in front of the ark of the Lord. While the trumpets were blowing, the armed troops went in front of them, and the rear guard went behind the ark of the Lord. On the second day, they marched around the city once and returned to the camp. So there's your order of march. Armed guard in front of the priest, the priest in front of the ark, and then the ark in front of the rear guard. And so they did this on the first day. The second day, they did this for 6 days. Verse 15, early on the seventh day, they started at dawn and marched around the city seven times in the same way. That was the only day they marched around the city seven times. After the seventh time, the priest blew the trumpets, and Joshua said to the people, "Shout, for the Lord has given you the city." So that blowing of the trumpets, that's the long blast when the people are supposed to shout. Long blast plus Joshua's command, they all shout. Quite dramatic, great stage effect. And again, I don't believe the shout had anything to do with naturally walking, knocking down the walls. I believe this was a miracle of God. He might have used the means of an earthquake or something, but the timing was obviously miraculous. Now, notice this on the seventh day. It is not known whether that seventh day was a Sabbath day, but one of the days of marching had to be a Sabbath. If you go 7 days, you're going to cross a Saturday somewhere. And so it occurred to me, seems like the Sabbath was profaned in order to take Jericho. Is this an exception, a necessity exception to the Sabbath law? For example, in Matthew 12, verses 3 through 8, Jesus said to them, the Pharisees, "Have you not read what David did when he became hungry, he and his companions, how he entered the house of God, and they ate the consecrated bread, which was not lawful for him to eat, nor for those with him, but for the priest alone?" So basically what Jesus is saying, they were starving, and we're going to let the law of self-preservation trump the Levitical laws about eating on the Sabbath. Dropping down to verse 8, Matthew 12, "For the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath." And so that would be the way I would take it. But Adam Clark has got an interesting take on this. He says this, "But it does not appear that there could be any breach in the Sabbath by the people simply going around the city, the ark and company, and the priest sounding the sacred trumpets. This was a mere religious procession performed at the command of God, in which no servile work was done." In other words, they weren't working on that Saturday that they walked around Jericho. They were just practicing their religion. I think Clark's got a good point there. I don't think I would want to accuse Joshua of breaking the Sabbath. We go now to Joshua 6, verses 17 through 19. "The city shall be under the ban, and all that is in it belongs to the Lord. Only Rahab the harlot and all who are with her in the house shall live, because she hid the messengers whom we sent. But as for you, only keep yourselves from the things under the ban, so that you do not covet them, and take some of the things under the ban, and make the camp of Israel accursed, and bring trouble on it. But all the silver and gold and articles of bronze and iron are holy to the Lord. They shall go into the treasury of the Lord." Now, Jericho's under the ban. What does that mean? NIV translates it as devoted. The city is devoted to God. The NIV note says this, "The Hebrew term refers to the irrevocable giving over of things or persons to the Lord, often by totally destroying them." And see verses 18 and 21, which we will. The KJV says, "The city shall be accursed." The Hebrew is kharem, if I pronounced that right. Please excuse me if I didn't. Kharem means anathema. Anathema means a curse. So the city is accursed. John Gill says concerning this, quote, "The city and the inhabitants of it shall be devoted to destruction, and the riches and spoil of it dedicated to sacred uses, and not become the property of the Israelites. For as this was the first city in the land of Canaan that was conquered, it was fit the first fruits of the conquest should be the Lord's, as an acknowledgment of his gift of the land unto them." Now, all of this might have been hard for the Israelites to take. their first city that they're going to conquer. It was rich, and they got no spoil, no booty. And you know soldiers love to have booty most of the time because their employers, their king, would be behind on pay 1, 2, or 3 years until the army finally mutinied and killed him. That's typical in the ancient world. Now, of course, that might not be typical of Israel's army. But nonetheless, there's all that spoil. They could have it. But Joshua announces clearly beforehand, so there would be no misunderstanding. The city's under the ban. You're not going to take anything for booty. Now, the ban means that everything is destroyed. What about the people in the city? Adam Clark says this. Here it seems to imply the total destruction of all the inhabitants. In fact, if we drop down to Joshua 6:21, Clark refers to that. They completely destroyed everything in the city with the sword, every man and woman, both young and old. Yes, it does. It sounds like they got them all. But Clark continues, it is likely that peace was offered to the city and that the extermination of the inhabitants was in consequence of the rejection of this offer. And that actually, in the ancient world or the medieval Western world, that happened a lot. You offered terms. If the city surrendered without a fight, saving a whole bunch of bloodshed, they were usually let go, taken as slaves or exiled or something, but they weren't killed. But if the city refused, all bets are off, and the besieging army can burn it to the ground if they can pull it off. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown say about this ban, the cherem or anathema, was a devotion to utter destruction. When such a ban was pronounced against a hostile city, the men and animals were killed. No booty was allowed to be taken. The idols and all the precious ornaments on them were to be burned, Deuteronomy 7:25. Everything was either to be destroyed or consecrated to the sanctuary. Some things couldn't be destroyed. Well, I guess they could be. Gold and silver, they could be burnt down and melted, but they got to keep that, unless it was devoted to idolatry. If it was devoted to idolatry, it had to be destroyed. Now, this total destruction of Jericho would paralyze the rest of Canaan. You can imagine the fear that the other Canaanite cities would feel when they saw this prosperous, large city lying in the rubble. And of course, the fear of the cities in Canaan would ultimately make the conquest of those cities much easier. Now, verse 17, Joshua tells the people that Rahab is going to be spared. You recall the story, of course. This was in a previous chapter, chapter 2. The priests come in, spy out Jericho. Rachel's living in Jericho. She's a harlot, most probably. She hides the spies in a pile of flax up on the roof, and the messengers from the king of Jericho can't find the spies. The spies come back. Rachel makes a deal. She said, look, I treated the spies well. Please treat me well when you take this city, which she assumed was going to happen, as it did happen. So that was the deal, and Joshua wants to honor it here, and he says, sure. You guys, when you go in and take Jericho, be sure you find Rahab and save her. She was saved as a result of her faith, Hebrews 11:31. By faith, Rahab the harlot did not perish along with those who were disobedient after she welcomed the spies in peace. And show God is not a respecter of persons there, of their status, a prostitute. But she showed faith in God, and so she was justified. That means vindicated, as in James 2:25. In the same way, was not Rahab the harlot also justified? In that case, justified means vindicated. Was she not vindicated by works when she received the messages and sent them out by another way? She was vindicated by what she did. Now, concerning this ban that the city was under, it kept the Israelites from taking spoil. That is only for cities that are under the ban. Generally, the Israelites were at liberty to take the spoil of other cities that were captured. We can see that in Deuteronomy 2:35, Deuteronomy 3:7, Joshua 8:27, which I won't quote to you, but if you read those verses, it says the Israelites took booty. So this was a special deal for Jericho. Some people have likened it to the first fruits. The first fruits go to God, so the city's under the ban, so everything goes to God. You don't get to keep anything. You get to keep what comes later, but not now. These are the first fruits. I mentioned earlier that the gold and silver and bronze went into the treasury except for those articles in connection with idolatry. We see that in Deuteronomy 7:25. The graven images of their gods you are to burn with fire. You shall not covet the silver or the gold that is on them, nor take it for yourselves, or you will be snared by it, for it is an abomination to the Lord your God. So with the exception of the idolatrous gold and silver, God got the rest of the gold and silver, and the people, the soldiers, got nothing. It was their offering to God. Joshua 6:20. and 21. So the people shouted, and priests blew the trumpets. And when the people heard the sound of the trumpet, the people shouted with a great shout, and the wall fell down flat, so that the people went up into the city, every man straight ahead, and they took the city. They utterly destroyed everything in the city, both man and woman, young and old, and ox and sheep and donkey, with the edge of the sword. So they shouted upon hearing that long blast mentioned in Joshua 6, verse 5. The walls fell down. Now people say, well, was it a direct miracle? Which it could be. Or was there a natural cause behind it that God caused to happen right at this time? For example, the shouting, the blowing of trumpets. I've already mentioned that can't be. Adam Clark's got a good quote here. He says, quote, "There has been much learned labor spent to prove that the shouting of the people might be the natural cause that the wall fell down!" Exclamation point. To wait here, either to detail or refute any such arguments, would be lost time. Enough of them may be seen in Schauchler, some scholar back in Clark's time. The whole relation evidently supposes it to have been a supernatural interference, as the blowing of the trumpets and the shouting of the people were too contemptible to be used even as instruments in this work, with the expectation of accomplishing it in a natural way. Well, of course not. However, Clark doesn't mention an earthquake. That, to me, earthquake tremors, that's something that would knock a wall down. That could have been the means that God used to knock the wall down. And by the way, Kathleen Kenyon in the 1950s dated the archaeological site at Jericho, and she said that in 1400 BC or 1200 BC, whether you take the early or late date of the Exodus, she says on either one of those dates, there was no walls there. Jericho didn't have any walls. But then other people have gone in and said she misdated the thing. Yes, they were. It's an interesting archaeological thing. I have no doubt that the walls were there and that they were knocked down, because I don't doubt the word of God. I believe it. That's part of my worldview. It is an interesting question, though, if you want to get into evidential type apologetics to study the archaeology behind the walls of Jericho. If you look on Google Images or do a search on Jericho, this whole big archaeological site that's still there, and there's all kinds of things that are there. Of course, Jericho is said to be the oldest inhabited city of the world. I think it's also the lowest. It's over 700 feet below sea level, and it's one of the oldest cities in the world. It's now controlled by the Palestinians, so if you go to Israel, you can't see it. But it really does look like an interesting archaeological site from the pictures. Now, some people have made a comparison of Jericho to Babylon the Great. Jericho was an obstacle to the people entering the Promised Land, and Babylon the Great was an obstacle to the spread of the gospel. Of course, when I say Babylon the Great, I'm talking about the new Babylon. Apostate Jerusalem in AD 70 is described in the book of Revelation. If you take an Orthodox preterist view of Revelation, which I do, and which explains a lot of things, well, let's look at Babylon the Great in Revelation. First of all, seven trumpets heralded its fall, just like with Jericho, Revelation 10:7. But in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, when he is about to sound, the mystery of God is finished. Now, that seventh angel is the seventh of the seven angels who blew trumpet judgments upon the new Babylon, apostate Jerusalem. We go to Revelation 11:15. Then the seventh angel sounded, same seventh angel, and there were loud voices in heaven saying, "The kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of our Lord and his Christ." More judgment upon apostate Israel, the new Babylon. Revelation 16:17. This is the seventh bowl angel, a different angel. Then the seventh angel poured out his bowl upon the air, and a loud voice came from the throne saying, "It is done." In Revelation 16:19, the great city was split into three parts, and the cities of the nations fell. Babylon the Great, again, that's referring to Israel, was remembered before God. Apostate Israel, the new Babylon. So, Babylon is judged just like Jericho is judged, with seven angels blowing a trumpet. Babylon is cursed, just like Jericho was cursed, remember? Anathema, harem, put under the ban, Jericho was. Revelation 18:21, then a strong angel took up a stone like a great millstone and threw it into the sea, saying, "So will Babylon, the great city, be thrown down with violence and will not be found any longer." And that's what happened to Jerusalem in AD 70. Cursed. Likewise, in Joshua 6:26, we see that Jericho is cursed. Then Joshua made them take an oath at that time, saying, "Cursed before the Lord is the man who rises up and builds this city, Jericho. With the loss of his firstborn, he shall lay its foundation, and with the loss of his youngest son, he shall set up its gates." We'll talk about that verse in just a minute, but the person who rebuilds Jericho will be cursed. So you see cursing and judgment landing on Babylon, the new Babylon, just like on Jericho, with seven angels. Now verse 21 says the city of Jericho was utterly destroyed. This is in accordance with the earlier divine command, Deuteronomy 7, 1 and 2, when the Lord your God brings you into the land where you are entering to possess it and clears away many nations before you, the Hittites, the Girgashites, seven nations greater and stronger than you, and the Lord your God delivers them before you and you defeat them, then you shall utterly destroy them. You shall make no covenant with them and show no favor to them. So they're proceeding as they were instructed earlier. They're not supposed to make treaties with these Canaanite nations. They're supposed to wipe them out. And, of course, we have the old problem, the ethical problem. Why is it moral to destroy women and babies? Because it says here the city was destroyed with the women and the young. Well, why? It's because the Canaanites were utterly depraved. Their cup of the iniquity had been filled up. You know, if you complain about that, well, what about when God destroyed the whole earth with Noah's flood? There were women and children destroyed in that flood. If the Canaanites were not utterly depraved, if they weren't destroyed, the kingdom of God would never have had a foothold on earth. The Israelites were constantly adapting Canaanite morality, and they came close to being destroyed by God because of their moral compromise. The Babylonian captivity was pretty horrible. These Canaanites were practicing child sacrifice, incest, murder, idolatry. They got what they deserved, so don't feel sorry for them any more than you feel sorry for Nazi Germany. This is an old apologetic question. I've got three apologetic sources right here in my notes. We're not going to go through all this, but we should note that this was a special case. In many other situations, the Jewish soldiers were forbidden to kill the women and the children. So it's only when there was extreme judgment being poured out that the women and children were killed. And also we need to note that this gives no one sanction for anyone. This gives no one sanction to commit genocide on anyone else. Only God has a right to command something like that. That's for his justice. We are not God. We can't say, well, we're going to wipe out this enemy of ours, men and women and children. You can't do that. But now think how horrible that must have been, or difficult it must have been for the Jewish soldiers to kill women and children. I think it'd be easy just to set the city on fire and turn away. I don't know, psychologically, that would be very, very difficult to do. It was a nasty world back then. Joshua 6, 22 through 25. Joshua said to the two men who had spied out the land, those are the two spies that went to Rahab's place, go into the harlot's house and bring the woman and all she has out of there, as you have sworn to her. So the young men who were spies went in and brought out Rahab and her father and her mother and her brothers and all she had. They also brought out all her relatives and placed them outside the camp of Israel. They burned the city with fire and all that was in it. Only the silver and gold and articles of bronze and iron they put into the treasury of the house of the Lord. However, Rahab the harlot and her father's household and all she had, Joshua spared, and she has lived in the midst of Israel to this day. For she hid the messengers whom Joshua sent to spy out Jericho. Now when did Joshua tell the two men to go into Rahab's house and get her family out? Could have been before the walls had fallen. Could have been after the walls had fallen. Doesn't matter, really. But whenever he told them that, the men had to go into the city and find Rahab's house. And the question arises, well, how did they know where Rahab's house was? Remember the deal the two spies had made with Rahab was that the scarlet thread was to be hung outside her window and the invading Israelites would spare her and her family. And it's nice here. It's kind of a poetic flourish here that the two men who were going to rescue Rahab are the two men that Rahab rescued when they were in trouble, when the messengers of the king of Jericho were looking for those two Hebrew spies. But how did the two spies know where Rahab's house was? Since the house has fallen down, the walls had fallen down. Well, here's some options to perhaps solve that. Number one, when the spies marched with people around the city, they observed the scarlet cord on the wall, thus memorizing the position of Rahab's house. And so then when they went into the city, they went to where Rahab's house was and they got her. Another difficulty. Joshua says, go into the harlot's house. Well, how can you go into a harlot's house when the house was probably not standing because it was hooked to the wall and the wall had fallen down? Well, some people get around that by saying, well, the whole wall fell except for where Rachel's house was, which would be a miracle, really, a providential working of God. Well, that's true. It could be just be Rachel and her family were huddled in the rubble that used to be their house. So when Joshua tells the two spies to go into the house, he means to go into the remains of the house where they're huddled up, probably scared to death. I didn't see a commentator that said that, but that's my speculation. I think it makes sense. Now in verse 23, Joshua says, get all that Rachel had and bring them out. Rahab, her father, her mother, her brothers, and all she had. That all would include Rahab's sisters, because Joshua 2:13, when Rahab was making the deal with the two spies, she said, I've treated you kindly, so how about spare my father and my mother and my brother and my sisters? So sisters weren't mentioned here, but we can assume that they were, of course, delivered also. And also her cattle and her material possessions could be included in that all. And they were to be taken outside the camp. Why outside the camp? Why not in the camp? Camp, I'm assuming, is still at Gilgal, about a little over a mile away from Jericho. Why outside the camp? Here's what John Gill says, quote, until they, Rahab and her family, became proselytes and embraced the religion of Israel, they were to be placed outside the camp. However, being Gentiles, some external rites and ceremonies were to be performed upon them, as well as a declaration at least of their renouncing idolatry was required of them before they could be admitted into the camp of Israel, and which was required even of a proselyte of the gate or of one that was only a sojourner among them. People who weren't Israelites who were living in Israel could be a visitor, a sojourner, temporary visitor, or could be a proselyte of the gate, someone who is permanently there but has not embraced the entire Hebrew religion. They did have to not be idol worshippers. They had to obey the basic laws. And then a proselyte of righteousness when they became a full-on Jew, where they get circumcised and go through all the feast and all that. So I don't know what Rahab and her family became, but they became Israelites of some sort. But they had to go through some ceremonies before they could be let in the camp, as John Gill speculates, I think reasonably. This outside the camp, that's usually meant for people who are ritually unclean, for example, lepers, shall live alone. His dwelling should be outside the camp while he's unclean, Leviticus 13:46, and then Miriam, when she got leprosy, Numbers 12:14, let her be shut up for 7 days outside the camp, and afterwards she may be received again. So this was a common ritual, legal, Levitical ritual, to get unclean people inside of Israel. Now notice in verse 25, it says, Rahab has lived in the midst of Israel to this day. Now in my introduction to Joshua in chapter 1, I said that many scholars say that this constant repetition of such and such and such is happening until this day seems to imply that it was later than Joshua's time that the book was written. And it does sound like that sometimes. However, Joshua did write the book. In Joshua 24, we see him sitting down and writing a book about all that had happened. And here, Rachel lives until this day. Well, that could easily be the time of Joshua, because Rachel only lived one lifetime. So it sounds like this day is relatively close to the time of Rachel's existence. And so that phrase, this day, does not necessarily mean that the book was written by Ezra and Samuel years later. I mean, this is 1400 B.C., Samuel is right before the kingdom, which is what, 1100 B.C. or so? I don't have the dates in front of me, but he's a good 3 centuries later. Rachel didn't live for 3 centuries. So whoever wrote this particular verse was living when Rahab was living, and it sounds to me like it was Joshua. Here's what Adam Clark says about that. This is one proof that the book was written at the time to which it is commonly referred, and certainly might have been done by the hand of Joshua himself, though doubtless many marginal notes may have since crept into the text, which to superficial observers give it the appearance of having been written after the days of Joshua. Jameson Fawcett Brown is even stronger than that. They say, quote, this is a proof that this book was written not long after the events related. We go now to Joshua 6, verses 26 and 27, and we will finish this chapter. Then Joshua made them take an oath at that time, saying, cursed before the Lord is the man who rises up and builds this city Jericho. With the loss of his firstborn he shall lay its foundation, and with the loss of his youngest son he shall set up its gates. So the Lord was with Joshua, and his fame was in all the land. Now this famous curse on Jericho, or actually on the man who rebuilds Jericho, it was fulfilled in a gentleman named Hiel the Bethelite, who was the rebuilder of the city in the times of Ahab 500 or 600 years later. Ahab ruled between 874 and 853 BC, according to Thiele. Several different datings of his, but roughly in the 9th century BC, and this is 1400 to 800. So you're talking about 300 or 400 years later, at least. Actually, Gill says 500 or 600 years later. 1400 minus 900 is 500, so I was wrong about 300. At least 500 years later, after this adjuration was made, after this curse was made, when either it was forgotten or however little regarded, they forgot about it, and so Hiel the Bethelite decides he's going to rebuild Jericho. Now we see in 1 Kings 16:34 what happened. In his days, that's referring to Ahab of Israel, and Ahab reigned between 874 and 853, according to the Thiele dating. In Ahab's days, Hiel the Bethelite built Jericho. He laid its foundations with the loss of Abiram, his firstborn, and set up its gates with the loss of his youngest son, Segub, according to the word of the Lord, which he spoke by Joshua, the son of Nun. And of course, that's Joshua chapter 6, verse 26, which we're reading right now. Now, the idea is when you're building a wall, you got to lay the foundations first. And so he did, and somehow his firstborn, Abiram, died. Hiel's firstborn, Abiram, died. And then you keep building the foundations, you set up the walls, and the last thing you put in is the gates in the walls. So the last thing he did as he finished, his youngest son died. Now, how they died, they could have died by natural reasons. They could have been divinely snuffed out. Maybe they even died suddenly in the process of building the wall. Maybe they died when they had a construction accident. I don't know. It's just speculation. But the point is, the curse was fulfilled. Now, there is another way you could read this, is that the oldest son died when the foundation was laid, then there were intermediate sons as the walls were being built, that they died, and finally the youngest son died when the gates were set up. I don't know if that really says that, but I think some people speculated that. Doesn't matter, you lose two sons, that's pretty much of a curse. Now, the purpose of this curse was that so the wall would be a perpetual reminder. Somebody starts rebuilding the wall, people need to remember, oh man, that was the wall that God knocked down. And wasn't there a curse attached to that wall? And people would remember. They would remember that God had judged the city and given victory to the Israelites. And let's face it, we're still talking today about the walls of Jericho. You ask the average Sunday school kid, what happened with Jericho? They say, oh yeah, the priests marched around for 7 days and they blew the trumpets and the walls fell down. Now, eventually the city was finally rebuilt. Notice that this curse did not say the city would never be rebuilt. It just said that somebody in the future was going to have his sons die rebuilding the city. So the city was rebuilt. In fact, it's there today, and it's said to be the oldest inhabited city in the history of the world. Here's what Gill says about the city of Jericho. This city became a very flourishing one in later times. We soon hear of the school of the prophets in it, 2 Kings 2. Here, Strabo says, the famous Greek geographer, here was a royal palace where, as Josephus relates, Herod died. That's Herod the Great. And who speaks of an amphitheater and hippodrome in it. In this city sometimes the Sanhedrin sat, and a great number of the stationary priests dwelt, even half a station, 12,000 of them, all of which is observed by Dr. Lightfoot. Our Lord himself honored it with his presence. That's what Gill says about Jericho. No, this is what Clark says about Jericho. Quote, we must not suppose that Jericho had been wholly neglected from its overthrow by Joshua to the days of Hiel. If it be the same, that's Hiel the Bethelite, the guy who was cursed with his sons dying. The city had not been wholly neglected. If it be the same city with the city of palm trees, mentioned Deuteronomy 34, verse 3, we find it mentioned as an inhabited place in the beginning of Judges 1, verse 16, a short time after the death of Joshua, and the children of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law, went up out of the city of palm trees with the children of Judah, and this said city was taken from the Israelites by Eglon, king of Moab. The ambassadors of David, who were disgracefully treated by Hanun, king of the Ammonites, were commanded to tarry at Jericho till their beards should grow. It appears, therefore, that there was a city which went under this name long before the time of Hiel, unless we can suppose that the city of palm trees was a different place from Jericho, the one that's mentioned in Deuteronomy 34, or possible that the name Jericho was given to some part of the circumjacent country after the city was destroyed, which is very probable. In other words, activity went on at Jericho after the walls fell down. The walls weren't built back for about 5 centuries, but before then there was Jericho. There was something near Jericho, something going on. This is what Clark says. After Hiel had rebuilt this city, it became of considerable consequence in the land of Judea. The courses of priests lodged there, because it was fairly close to Jerusalem, so they could run in to do their monthly service. the priest who lodged there, who served in their turns at the temple. There was a school of the prophets there, which was visited by Elijah and Elisha in 2 Kings 2. And it was at this city that our Lord miraculously healed blind Bartimaeus. It is now deserted. Now is in the time of Clark's writing, which is the 19th century. It is now deserted, having but 30 or 40 miserable cabins in it, which serve for a place of refuge to some wretched Moors and Arabs who live there like beasts. The plain of Jericho, formerly so celebrated for its fertility, is at present uncultivated, producing nothing but a few wild trees and some very indifferent fruits. Well, that was in the 1800s. It's recovered since then. You can look on Wikipedia, and if you could get into the Palestinian-occupied territory, you can actually see it. But anyway, I go through all that to say, no, Jericho was not wiped out completely. It's just the curse was not that it would be wiped out. The curse was that anybody tried to build those walls again would have his kids die. And that did happen. So ladies and gentlemen, we are now finished with Joshua chapter 6, verses 1 through 27, the fall of Jericho. That prepares us to proceed to the next chapter, chapter 7 of Joshua. Now in Joshua 7, we will go from the sublime to the sad, because Israel is going to be defeated at Ai in chapter 7. So I hope you stay tuned with me to look at that, verses 1 through 26 of Joshua 7, and I hope you enjoyed this discussion of the fall of Jericho in chapter 6. See you next time.